What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Jesse Strauss.
This week marks 9 full months of Israel's ongoing genocide in Gaza, as we've done just about every Monday here on Law and Disorder since October. We'll turn back today to our recurring segment, The Palestine Post, talking about the latest news and analysis from Israel's genocide on Gaza and the efforts that people are taking from across the world to stop it. We'll be spending the whole hour today in conversation with Nora Barrows-Friedman, a staff writer and editor at the Electronic Intifada and also a former KPFA host and producer. Nora, thank you for joining us again.
Thanks for having me again, Jesse.
It's a pleasure and an honor as always, Nora, and we hope that we'll be able to have you on in the future to talk about happy news, but of course we do start these Monday mornings talking about the latest news and developments. Just over the weekend, a report came out in The Lancet, which estimates conservatively that while the death toll in Gaza is reportedly around 38,000, and that's according to the Gaza Health Ministry, that if Israel stopped its aggression right now, that the number of deaths we'd end up counting directly related to this aggression would be in the range of at least 186,000. The report talks about indirect deaths, meaning from causes like reproductive, communicable, and non-communicable diseases. That figure of 186,000 is roughly 8% of the entire population of Gaza. So I'm interested in your thoughts on this report. But I'm actually wondering if we can start by helping to frame the numbers that we get from the Gaza Health Ministry. How do these counts happen?
Yeah.
And what do we know about their accuracy? And then we'll get into the report.
Yeah. And just to start by saying that the Lancet report is a conservative estimate. So 186,000 is a conservative estimate. Most likely a mass undercount. But in terms of the number that the Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza has been putting out day after day, it has been hovering around 37,000 for months now. And the reason why it's been stuck at that number is because Israel has systematically obliterated the Health Ministry's bureaucratic capabilities. Israel has obliterated nearly all of the hospitals and clinics in Gaza. And that's how any health ministry in the world, that's how they measure their casualty counts, is from people coming in to the hospital and being registered on the governmental, civil registry with death certificates. And because Israel has completely destroyed the civil administration buildings, the internet has been out for 8.5 months now. Those figures that the health ministry is forced to put out is only what they have managed to be able to record under the circumstances. And so for the past 5-6 months of this 9 months of genocide, the government ministries have been saying that what is being officially counted is only what they can count under the circumstances, and that number obviously doesn't account for the tens of thousands of Palestinians under the rubble who have been stuck under the rubble and left to decompose and decay, since the beginning of the genocide 9 months ago. So with the Lancet's very meticulous approach in determining the number of casualties, it's not only the numbers of people killed during these fire belts attacks, these attacks with 2,000-pound bombs, these bunker buster bombs on people, displaced people in tents, which happened today and has been happening systematically for months. It is also, as you mentioned, an estimate of people who are starving to death, are being dehydrated, don't have access to their life-saving medications. There are 10,000 cancer patients in Gaza who have been prevented from accessing treatment. And this is not just over the last 9 months. This is after 17 years of the Israeli blockade on Gaza. I mean, before the genocide began in October, you know, we at the Electronic Intifada had for 17 years been talking about the lack of access to life-saving medications, especially on the most vulnerable populations, the elderly and the children. How there is only one cancer hospital in the Gaza Strip, which Israel destroyed. And there is only one pediatric oncology unit, which Israel destroyed. And so we're talking about, so there's people who have been killed, you know, by these just merciless, relentless attacks in this genocide, outright, you know, buildings literally falling on top of them. And then there are people who somehow survive an attack, but they need to be amputated without anesthesia. And those injuries, for example, I mean, you talk to any doctor in Gaza, any doctor anywhere in the world, and they'll tell you it's not just this one surgery. Like, an amputation needs multiple surgeries over multiple years, especially for children, because their bodies grow, their bones grow, and they need successive surgeries for the rest of their lives, probably. And so those figures enter into the Lancet's estimate of 186,000, conservatively, again, I repeat. And then you have reproductive harm on the population, where, you know, women are now suffering like an absolutely extraordinary number of miscarriages and infant mortality because of the malnutrition of the mother, and of stress and shock and dehydration. I mean, it's like the middle of summer and it is scorching hot. And there are no safe places to give birth. There's no safe place for a normal cesarean. And again, that's a major abdominal surgery that needs not just, you know, anesthesia, which they don't have, but basic surgical supplies, which are you know, almost gone at this point. I mean, it's hard for people to get Tylenol and ibuprofen, let alone anesthesia during, a surgery like that. And so there's another effect of this genocide. And then you're talking about the nutritional effects. You know, nearly all of Gaza's agricultural lands have been systematically decimated and destroyed by the Israelis over the last 9 months, plus the 17 years of the siege that came before. And so there are, I mean, there's little to none fresh produce or dairy in Gaza right now, especially since Israel has sealed the borders and, very few trucks are allowed to come in. They're being subjected to just arbitrary and ridiculous searches by the Israeli military. Before October 7th, a minimum of 500 trucks were required to come in per day to the Gaza Strip to address the overwhelming need for produce and school books and cloth for clothing and diapers and maxi pads and medications and medical supplies. And now a trickle is being let in. And as I said, they're being subjected to arbitrary searches. Nothing to address the absolutely enormous need of people who are suffering every conceivable way under this genocide,
right,
especially in the north of Gaza, which has been just completely sealed off by the Israelis. And then you have, absolute trauma. I mean, physical and psychological trauma that is also a factor in these deaths. It's unimaginable how much destruction Israel has wrought on the Gaza Strip and across historic Palestine as a whole over the last 76 years, obviously. But the Lancet was very careful in saying that this is a very conservative estimate. And especially if this weaponized, starvation policy, using food as a weapon to try and defeat the Palestinians. Not only is it going to accelerate deaths in many different ways, but it is obviously a deeply sadistic policy that Israel has employed. And it is, under the genocide conventions, if anything means anything anymore, it certainly falls within the context of genocidal intent, and Israel should be prosecuted at the international courts. Well, we have yet to see if that'll happen, but that's just an overview.
Yeah, it's a humbling overview. And we're 12 minutes into our conversation and we've only asked one question, and there's so much in there that I want to get into the juice of, because it's hard for me to just imagine what it takes for the Gaza Health Ministry to, first of all, exist under this genocidal policy, but also try to maintain these counts and do so accurately with an incredible amount of international eyes on what they're doing. Again, we have no idea about the numbers of people who are under the rubble. We're talking about a Lancet report that came out just a few days ago saying conservatively that the indirect numbers of dead from Israel's aggression in Gaza since October could reach 186,000. And they did their research based on other types of conflicts. But Palestine and Gaza specifically is a pretty unique context. And Nora, I want to thank you for giving us some of that context in the fact that Gaza was not able to receive as much medication as they needed for basic services prior to this genocide.
Right.
And it's hard to imagine what kinds of medical or any kind of services that folks in Gaza, Palestinians in Gaza, might be able to receive at some point when Israel stops its bombardments. We're going to get more into the bombardments and the potential to stop it a little bit later. I also wanted to ask you about another report that came out over the weekend that showed that since this current round of violence in Gaza, Israel has settled more land in the West Bank than they had in any similar time frame in over 30 years. That's since like the Oslo time. The IMEU, the Institute for Middle East Understanding, quotes Israel's finance minister saying, and this is a quote, "For every country that unilaterally recognizes a Palestinian state, we will establish a settlement." And he's working on plans, supposedly, to bring 1 million Israeli settlers onto Palestinian land right now. That would be a million more settlers. What do you know, Nora, about Israel's land grab specifically since October or in this year?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to assess the political performance of Smotrich's announcement there, because the Israeli cabinet, the top officials, Smotrich being one, Itamar Ben-Gvir, the national security minister, being another, these are very to call them far right would be too kind. I mean, they're extremists, they're fanatics. They are the most honest face of the Zionist project. They are unabashedly, unashamedly racist and genocidal.
As opposed to the members who right. are just quietly racist and genocidal?
Right. They kind of have to play along kind of thing. I mean, the entire project itself, since its inception 40 years ago, has always been a racist settler colonial project. But they wanted to be kind of, you know, there's like a respectability sort of politics that they've been employing in some ways, at least at like, you know, the top echelons, even though they were the ones, these, you know, so-called doves, you know, what, these genocidal doves of, you know, during the Oslo years, for example, where they were just, you know, they were nicer to you know, the West, to the Western leadership. They weren't so belligerent as they were stealing Palestinians' land and massacring Palestinians and enacting laws that solidify apartheid as a legal tenet of their state, right? As they were carrying out the long, slow process of ethnic cleansing under the nose of the West, right? Now they're just more open and honest about it. There's not really a political, ideological change. They're just more honest. And so you have Smotrich and you have Ben-Gvir backed by these very fanatical settler extremist movements who are, I mean, it's not like they've been impeded in land grabs. It hasn't stopped. There's not been, you know, it's not, you know, now it's just maybe there's like some attention to it now that the Israeli government has like approved the tenders for what is it, like 30,000 new housing units in the occupied mm-hmm. West Bank. I think it's a political ploy to garner even more support within the Israeli public to say, look, we're not losing in Gaza, even though they know they're losing in Gaza, even though their military is completely falling apart, their economy is in complete shambles, their GDP. I'm not an economist. I cannot make sense of economic you know, speak, but from what I know, if your GDP has fallen 20% in a matter of like 5 or 6 months, I think that's pretty bad. I understand that much, and that number is from a few months ago. So I expect that the GDP has tanked even more. Israel's, you know, credit rating is in the toilet. Major companies are pulling out. I know we'll get to the boycott movement in a bit, but like people don't see Israel as a viable, sustainable market investment as they did 9 months ago. And so I think, you know, that the internal political struggles are what is driving Smotrich and Ben-Gvir and Netanyahu and all these fascists toward celebrating and kind of rubbing people's noses in the fact that all these tenders for new settlements in the West Bank have been approved. I think that's just to kind of boost the morale of the Israeli public, who want nothing less than full ethnic cleansing of Palestinians from Palestine. I mean, the land grabs in the occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem, have not stopped for the last 30 years. They have been accelerating. They've been ongoing. There have been pogroms by these like fascist settler groups backed by the Israeli military, of course. I mean, it's like Clark Kent and Superman, of course. They have killed hundreds of Palestinians, including Palestinian children, since October 7th. during these pogroms in Palestinian cities, towns, and villages, where they go and they destroy people's houses, they burn crops, they shoot and kill all the livestock, they kidnap children, beat them up. I mean, this is all a part of the settler land grab policy, is to instill fear and terror into the Palestinian population in the places where they have set their sights on, expanding their settlement colonies. And then they just get the state to approve it. So there's nothing new. It's just maybe a little bit more visible.
Yeah, I wanted to go back to the comment that you made about visibility, because it seems like Israel's horrific violence in Gaza is certainly bringing an international focus on Israel's apartheid policies more broadly than just what it's doing in Gaza.
Yeah.
But that said, I also wanted to give a shout out and wondering if you have any other information about other ways that visibility is being promised right now. I know that the International Solidarity Movement has relaunched, and that's a movement to bring international outsiders to be a protective presence in West Bank areas for Palestinians. Wondering if you can talk about that, or also just broadly the visibility portion, and why that's different now. And for listeners who are just tuning in, we're in conversation with Nora Barrows-Friedman, a staff writer and editor at the Electronic Intifada.
Yeah, I mean, I think the visibility issue is an important one. Like, as you said, the entire world's eyes are on Gaza. And meanwhile, you know, the violence, the ethnic cleansing, the slow motion genocide is also occurring apace in the occupied West Bank. And inside, you know, present day Israel, but Palestinians refer to as 1948 Palestine, where, you know, the Jewish Israeli settlers who have all the power are being given the green light even more. There's never been, I mean, it's kind of hard to say like they were restrained beforehand. They've never been restrained. They've always been able to kill and terrorize and ethnically cleanse at their will. There's been no repercussions for anything ever. And I think that, I don't know. I mean, it could be like a generational thing, you know, Gen Z and the millennial generation especially have been at the forefront here in the United States and in Canada and across Europe. In all the places that protect Israel in lockstep with Western empire and the values that come with it, they are not buying Israel's lies anymore. They're not buying the lie of Zionism. They're not buying Zionism as some sort of like protected identity class anymore. And I think they're looking at Israel's behavior, not just in Gaza, but across Palestine and across the world, as something that needs to be corrected and challenged and eventually dismantled as an ideology and as a facet of white supremacy in general. And so I think, you know, you should talk to someone like David Sheen or Shir Hever, who know intimately the cultural paradigm and the zeitgeist maybe of Israeli political culture, where the more that the world rejects Israeli belligerence and violence and genocidal rhetoric, the more that mainstream Israelis amplify that violence and kind of taunt the world that they can do whatever they want. And it's a really, I mean, there's, you know, it's hard to understand the psychology of that, where they really don't care what the world thinks. They're going to do this anyway. They're going to do it, you know, even worse the next day. It is a culture of impunity. It's a society without any repercussions for the way that it behaves and the way that that they're allowed to behave at the international level. And so I think, I don't know, I mean, that might have something to do with it. It's really difficult to rationalize the, the state project in itself what it does to the colonizer themselves. I mean, France Fanon talks a lot about that, where, you know, we also need to figure out what to do with this belligerent colonialism. First we protect its victims, and then we try and figure out how to protect the world from the victimizers.
I do want to give a particular mention of the International Solidarity Movement. It's a movement of folks from around the world going to the West Bank and certainly trying to bring visibility to Israel's land grabs there. And I also want to mention that later in this week, we're going to get a report from three Bay Area activists who just returned from the West Bank doing international solidarity movement visibility work. I'm going to move us along in this conversation to another piece of news that dropped over the weekend. The Israeli news source, Haaretz, is reporting that on October 7th, Israel used the Hannibal Directive, an Israeli military plan that includes killing their own people in order to prevent Israelis from being taken hostage. Nora, this is a story that hits in many ways for many reasons. Before we get into your own relationship to it and the relationship of the Electronic Intifada, I'm wondering if you can just outline and give us a clearer sense of what actually is the Hannibal Directive.
Yeah. So the Hannibal Directive is a policy that Israel used during its war on Lebanon, where in order to prevent the capture of their soldiers, they would rather kill the Israeli soldiers than have them be taken captive in order to prevent prisoner swaps down the road. I mean, it's kind of a, you know, when you really think about it, you know, Israel kind of portrays itself as like, you know, not just the most moral army in the world, which is, it's like ludicrous that any army can be moral, but that Israel's is the most moral army, right? And that there's this whole kind of propaganda around Israel's military where they're like so proud of their soldiers and they take care of their soldiers and, you know, the soldiers are the heart of the country and all of this. I mean, it sounds very familiar to our country and how we treat our veterans afterwards, right? But in this case, I mean, not even like the depraved U.S. military would rather kill their own soldiers than have them be taken alive. The Israeli military not just has this as a policy, it's been kind of secretive in the last few decades. It's been kind of an open secret, but they've never really admitted until now that they have used the Hannibal Directive. And as we at the Electronic Intifada reported, as many Palestinian journalists reported in the days, you know, even the hours after October 7th, Israel used the Hannibal Directive against its own civilians in order to prevent them from being taken to Gaza, in order to, in order to have a prisoner swap, which is what the Palestinian fighters wanted. That was the whole intention of, the prison break on October 7th, was to capture as many Israeli soldiers as possible in order to exchange them for the thousands of Palestinian prisoners languishing and being tortured in Israeli dungeons, including hundreds and hundreds. It's up to, I think, over 1,000 now, children. Those of us in the Western media, and certainly Palestinians who were watching this happen, were told that we were completely deranged for thinking that Israel would ever fire on their own civilians and then blame Palestinians for the deaths of the Israelis in Kibbutz Be'eri and the other kibbutzes around the Gaza envelope.
And just to be clear, Nora, when did the Electronic Intifada report on the Hannibal Directive being used on October 7th?
I believe it was just a few days afterwards.
Right.
Our friend and colleague, comrade and contributor to the Electronic Intifada, Dr. Rifat Al-Arir, actually tweeted it within hours of the prison break. And he said, he had drone footage and he tweeted it out. You can go to his Twitter. He was assassinated by Israel in December, but his Twitter is still active. It's still up. And you can see on October 7th, he was tweeting. And he tweeted out this video image of infrared drone footage of a massive explosion on the road near wherever the Supernova Festival was. Explosions that could not have been made by the weapons that the Palestinian fighters were carrying. We're talking, AK-47s and a couple of rocket-propelled grenades, very small munitions compared to the destruction that that any forensic, investigator could see clearly. But Israeli soldiers themselves who were tasked with going to the kibbutzes on October 7th, they were told to shoot everything that moves. They were told, they brought tanks, they shelled with tank shells, enormous tank shells, into the homes of these kibbutz residents. And then they, I don't know if you remember that photo of the hundreds of incinerated cars lined up.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes.
That we were then told was, were all set fire by Palestinians. There is no way that an AK-47 or a small RPG can incinerate hundreds of cars within a few minutes. It just doesn't, that doesn't make sense. And this was covered in Hebrew media. I'm not just making this up, obviously. But this has been covered in Hebrew language media for months, that there were Apache helicopter gunships, launched by the Israeli military, who were shooting at everything that moved in order to prevent Israelis from being captured and taken into Gaza, including firing upon cars. And then you have these testimonies by Israelis themselves who survived being shot at by Israeli Apache helicopter gunships and Israeli tanks, who said, our boys were shooting at us. But we were told, and everyone who reported this was told, that we were, akin to 9/11 truthers. The Washington Post a few months ago, it could have been 6 months. I have no concept of time right now, but the Washington Post put out a hit piece on us and other independent media outlets.
Us being the Electronic Intifada.
Yeah, the Electronic Intifada, the Gray Zone, and Mondo Weiss, saying that we were conspiracy theorists for pointing out exactly what was being reported by the Israeli media in Hebrew language only. And we we have yet to need to issue, like, we don't, there has not been one fact that we have gotten wrong. And if there was, we would issue a correction. The New York Times, the Washington Post, you know, MSNBC, CNN, you name it, every single vaunted corporate media outlet, and some independent media outlets too, have parroted this line that Hamas went in to the kibbutzes in order to slaughter Jews, to rape women, because they hate Jews and they hate women. There's, you know, nothing about the actual plans, which are there in plain sight. Anyone can read them, about capturing Israeli soldiers and swapping them in a prisoner exchange. And of course, there's still not a shred of evidence, no matter how much Sheryl Sandberg wants to pretend there is, that a single Israeli woman was raped, let alone systemic mass rapes on October 7th. And of course, that you know, there's, I mean, that Palestinians wanted to kill Jews because they hate Jews and they're anti-Semites and they're barbaric. Where do we hear that kind of rhetoric before, right? I mean, we heard it in the Jim Crow South against Black people, Black men in particular. We hear that about Latin American men in here in California, right? Yeah. Anyway, these tropes are important to recognize, and they're something that we've been pointing out for the last 9 months that have been used as a weapon to justify the mass slaughter, the actual sexual violence and assault of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip and inside the Israeli prisons. And so now, 9 months later, even though Israeli media, Hebrew language media, have been reporting on, you know, the Israeli helicopter gunships that were mowing people down on October 7th, and the Israeli tanks and the machine gunners inside those tanks who were ordered to kill anybody that moved inside the houses, doesn't matter if they're, you know, Israelis or Palestinians. Finally, Haaretz, the Tel Aviv newspaper, came out with an English language article saying exactly what we've been saying and what Palestinians have been reporting on for 9 months. So it's like, it feels like total gaslighting, obviously, but it's also a vindication that we're not conspiracy theorists.
Right.
We have been meticulously looking at the facts. We have been meticulously documenting the trajectory of these lies and the propaganda machine that is being used to justify the genocide of Palestinians.
Well, and it is 9 months later that these reports are coming out in other media, and Electronic Intifada was certainly doing some of this work very early on. I think it's also worthwhile to note that now that it's being reported in English on Haaretz, it's also being carried by other major mainstream news sources. I wonder if you have any, and I have more questions for you, and we don't have that much time. So very, very quick reflection on just the value of having this in the public sphere, even if it's not coming from a source that came out 9 months ago. It should have come out 9 months ago. In the broad public.
Right. Exactly. I mean, I don't know. I haven't seen any US based corporate media outlet talking about this, actually. Like, I have yet to see not just the Haaretz report being reported on by the Washington Post or New York Times in the light that it should be reported on, but I've yet to see them report on the Lancet's report about a conservative estimate that 186,000, which is 8% of the Gaza population, you know, has been wiped out or will be wiped out. And, you know, I was talking to some friends today about it. I mean, I remember when the Lancet came out 15 years ago with a report saying that 1 million Iraqis have been killed. not just from American bombs and weapons, but from the after effects, like the Lancet said about what's happening in Gaza, you know, just reproductive violence, you know, systematic deprivation of nutrients in the soil, you know, the effects of white phosphorus and depleted uranium, and the, you know, generations of children now with birth defects, that and of course, like, you know, political chaos. I have yet to, I don't think a single, you know, major corporate news outlet ever covered that Lancet article. And my friend was pointing out that the Lancet also came out, you know, before I was born, talking about the millions of deaths in Vietnam because of the U.S.'s weapons and the after effects, including the total degradation of the soil and the usage of Agent Orange and napalm and all of that. So, I mean, we see a pattern here when it comes to protecting U.S. empire and its weapons, and diminishing the actual numbers of people who are being slaughtered in many different and unimaginably horrible ways. I don't know what the U.S. media is going to do with this Haaretz report. I know that we'll be waiting for an apology from the Washington Post any day now. Mm-hmm. I don't see that coming. I don't see any recognition of the independent journalists, and especially the Palestinian journalists who have literally put their lives on the line. I mean, 160 Palestinian journalists have been killed in the last 9 months. The most dangerous place in the world to be a journalist right now is in Gaza. And we have yet to see, you know, any major international or, you know, American journalistic association say a word, a single word about their colleagues who are being killed. We have yet to see any CNN journalist talk about the 160 Palestinian journalists who have been killed while reporting, while sleeping in bed with their families, while trying to find shelter, while trying to find cancer medication. So again, Palestinians are betrayed by the West. They're betrayed by the empire. You know, it's up to the world, civil society, whatever's left of it, hasn't betrayed them. We, you know, people are rising up in the millions all over the world every day, trying to do whatever they can to stop this genocide and to stop this belligerence and to stop the U.S. empire from enabling this. I mean, I think that's what gives me a little bit of hope. That the world, that this is a different world than it was on October 6th, that Palestinians are going to be, seeing their own liberation sooner rather than later, that the end of Zionism is happening. And, you know, it's that time of, like, you know, where do you want to be at this time in history? How do you want to tell the story to your grandchildren? Did you support people in their fight for liberation, or did you just watch it happen?
And that's the voice of Nora Barrows Friedman, a staff writer and editor at the Electronic Intifada. And you are listening to Law and Disorder on KPFA. Nora, I could talk to you all day. I have two more questions that I'm hoping you'll be generous enough to bear with me on before we sign off for the day. Right now, various negotiators from Israel as well as from Hamas are headed to Cairo and also Doha to work on some kind of truce or ceasefire deal. On Sunday, thousands of Israelis protested in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, even them trying to pressure the Netanyahu government to reach a deal. In Tel Aviv, the father of one of the Israeli captives who's held in Gaza was quoted by Al Jazeera saying, and this is the quote, "Our message to the government is very simple. There is a deal on the table. Take it." Nora, I'm wondering, in your assessment, where are we at in negotiations, and is the possibility of attaining a deal that will be accepted on all sides actually on the table? Do you see room for something to come out of this in any lasting way?
I mean, look, Israel could have had their captives back on October 8th, you know?
Yeah.
That was the deal then. And they chose not to take the deal. They chose to enact a genocide of historic proportions instead. They chose to abandon their own people, just as they enacted the Hannibal Directive on their own people in Kibbutz Be'eri and the other kibbutzes. They're enacting a Hannibal Directive on their, on the people who are still, you know, waiting for the deal to be negotiated. Hamas has always said since day one, this is the deal. You release the prisoners, you end the siege, and you stop occupying us. Very reasonable demands in any other context. Israel has not been willing to take any deal that doesn't allow it to keep killing Palestinians, keep subjugating Palestinians, keep occupying Palestinians, and keep Palestinians in torture dungeons and concentration camps in the desert.
And that's not even to mention Biden's announcement a month or so back saying that he was announcing a deal that Israel was up for.
Right.
And it turned out that Israel was the party that rejected it.
That's right. That's right. And no matter, you know, how many facts about this that you can have on the table, they're still going to say that it's in Hamas's court. It's complete BS, you know. I mean, Hamas has been very clear. They've been unwavering in these negotiations. It has been Israel and the U.S. that have said, no, we want a deal that doesn't give the Palestinians any rights and that Israel gets to keep killing them. And Palestinians aren't going to accept that deal. I mean, they'd be crazy. After all of this, to accept a deal that keeps Israel, able to genocide them at will, it's not going to happen. Like I mentioned, Israel's economy is in shambles. Israel's, their society is completely turning against each other. People are leaving the country for good. No one really wants to do business with Israel anymore. They become the global pariah that we've always known them to be. But in other countries around the world, you know, people don't want anything to do with Israel. It's a losing investment, and they're losing the war militarily. They're really good at genociding people, but not one of their actual demands, not one of their objectives has ever been met in the last 9 months. You know, they wanted to, I mean, this whole, I mean, it's in, you know, it kind of harkens back to the language that the US and the UK used about the so-called war on terror. We're going to win a war on terror, right? When it just meant we're just going to kill people and become the terrorists. So Israel wants to eliminate Hamas, as though Hamas is like a non-human entity, that, you know, cartoonish sort of thing. Israel and the U.S. want a Gaza that is governed by people that they hand select, right? So like a Palestinian Authority sort of Vichy government who will come in and do a neoliberal shock doctrine and keep Israel happy and keep Israel able to keep stealing resources and land and keep occupying and keep killing whenever they want to. That's not a deal. That's not a negotiation. It is up, you know, if Israel wants their captives back, then they're going to have to agree to a deal that is reasonable. And that deal has been on the table for 9 months. And I think at some point, I don't know. I mean, I think at some point they're going to have to take it. These families of hostages, I mean, just imagine like these families whose, sons and daughters and brothers and sisters have been being held held captive in Gaza quite well, I might add, especially, you know, opposed to how Israel is treating Palestinians in prisons. To have the government say, actually, we don't care about your sons and daughters and brothers and sisters. We're, you know, we just want to keep killing Palestinians. And the fact that I think an estimate like 60 of the Israeli captives have been killed in Israeli bombings. This is Israel eating itself. This is the Israeli project of settler colonialism and this like deranged ideology of Zionism that has always been unsustainable, that will always, consume itself out of existence. And I think we're seeing that.
And it also speaks to the Hannibal directive that we about earlier, which, you know, it now is reported by Haaretz that it's was called into action on October 7th. Yeah. But the fact that Israel is killing its own hostages in the process of genociding Palestinian Gazans.
Yeah. I mean, we need like a psychologist to make sense of this for us.
Nora, I have one more question before we end, and it's I love having you on the show. I wish we had more fun and positive things to talk about.
We will someday.
We will someday. I wanted to end on this one note that pulls us in that direction a little bit, which is news from this past week that the General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church in the U.S. voted this past week to divest from Israeli bonds. Mm-hmm. That formation, the Presbyterian Church, has about 8,800 churches and represents about 1 million church members. Where are we at in this moment of boycott and divestment, which has been a campaign for many, many years? We're getting this news about the Presbyterian Church. The entire student intifada was focused on students demanding that their own tuition was not invested in companies that aid Israel or that benefit from Israel or that are headquartered there. Where do you see the boycott and divestment movement at this point in time? To my mind, it seems like there's some major growth points and major successes.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Presbyterian Church has for decades done incredible work in their congregations to divest from various companies that profit from Israel's genocide and occupation. I believe in the same vote, they also took a very bold stance against Christian Zionism, which is, you know, there are more Christian Zionists in this country than there are Jewish Zionists.
That's right.
And, you know, I mean, we could spend a whole show talking about Christian Zionism. So the Presbyterians taking a stance, not just an economic boycott Israeli products and Israeli, contracts, but also taking an ideological stand that says that Zionism has no place in this community from anybody, which I think is really important. And I think, just in the last few weeks, Intel, the big microchip maker, right, announced that it was not going to go ahead with a $25 billion deal in Israel. Israel is known as the so-called startup nation. A lot of like Silicon Valley companies, have campuses there or have factories there. There's a lot of relationships between California and present-day Israel in terms of their tech sector. They're kind of like, you know, presented on the world stage as like, you know, kind of the next frontier and, you know, big tech kind of thing. Their tech sector is completely collapsing. Intel itself, I can't remember where it must have been Reuters or something, but like, you know, the Israel factory of Intel, they have a smaller factory that's still there. It's basically, I don't know, it's probably not inoperable completely, but like they're having a really hard time maintaining their factory because a lot of their employees are also reservists, and Israel keeps calling up reservists for like, you know, second, third, fourth tours in Gaza to blow up little children. And so they're having a hard time, I think, financially. Intel said, Intel was planning this massive, second factory right outside of, I think it's between like Gaza and Tel Aviv. And they just announced that they were pulling out of that deal. You know, they said it, they kind of couched it in this like weird kind of boilerplate tech speak, right? They're like, you know, well, the market conditions, you know, it's not a good investment right now because of market conditions. We really love working in the region sort of thing, but we're just not going to, we just can't go through with this deal. So not saying anything explicit about, you know, Israel is a bad investment and this is basically a boycott, but it has been one of the biggest boycott victories in the last few years. And so I think, you know, from like a massive, you know, multi-billion dollar Intel deal to the Presbyterians saying, we're not going to do business. We don't want anything to do with this genocide, to students, like you said, the student intifada over the last few months. I mean, now we're in summer, but it's probably going to, you know, gear back up again in about a month or so when students come back to class. It's really made clear, I think, to these institutions, whether they're institutions of higher learning, whether they're Silicon Valley giants, whether they're, you know, mom and pop stores that sell Israeli products, that people don't want anything to do with this genocide. They don't want to support it. They don't want their tuition dollars going to support it. They don't want their pensions going to support it. There's so many similarities between, the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement against apartheid South Africa that, you know, our parents' generation was involved in. And, you know, it wasn't the thing that, of course, brought down apartheid South Africa, but it was something that international civil society could organize around and could actually campaign for. You know, South Africans under apartheid, they fought for their liberation struggle themselves. And they did it through civil disobedience. They did it through armed resistance. They did it through political education. And they did it with the help of international civil society engaging with the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. And I think that's exactly what we're seeing right now in Palestine for Palestinians, where, you know, we're 10,000 miles away. What can we do? For a lot of people, that is trying to get their city councils to stop investing in Israel bonds. For many people, that's, you know, trying to get their churches or their synagogues or their community centers to stop investing, you know, in companies that facilitate Israel's genocide against Palestinians. And the other thing that people are doing is that is actually like a material, something material that people can help with is going to the website gazafunds.org, gazafunds, F-U-N-D-S. And that is a platform that people I know have put together where it is like a collection of vetted, like, you know, verified and vetted GoFundMes to help people rebuild their lives, rebuild their country, to help people with medical expenses in Gaza, to help people get food and solar panels. Really incredible work that people are doing. It, you know, this kind of work isn't it's not easy and it feels overwhelming, but there are so many ways that people can plug in, whether it's through, you know, sending $10 to someone so that they can, you know, have surgery, or evacuate Gaza for medical needs. Or if it's, you know, joining a coalition in your neighborhood to try and get your city council to divest from Israeli bonds. There are so many ways you can plug in, and it's just about consistency and maintaining relationships with people in your community.
Well, Nora Barris Friedman, I want to thank you for joining us this morning. We're going to have to leave it there. I, again, could talk to you all day, and I look forward to having you on in the future to talk about more positive things. But for now, thank you so much for joining us again on Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much, Jesse.
And that's the voice of Nora Barris Friedman, a staff writer and editor at the Electronic Intifada.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.